Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to Start Your Week from the Bunker. I'm Andrew Harrison, here to wipe away your weekend hangovers and explain the hangovers of the week ahead is Naomi Smith. Good morning, Naomi. How are you?
Good morning, Andrew. Not too bad, thanks.
Good. Did you have a wild and looking weekend of beer garden wildness?
I didn't. We worked incredibly hard at Best for Britain last week because obviously we launched our UK Trade and Business Commission. We had our first live evidence session that Hilary Benn was chairing, but we had lots of industrialists there. We had representatives from every Westminster political party, and we had evidence from Thomas Sampson from the LSE, Vicky Price, and also Julian Jessop from the IEA. So it was a very interesting session, and there was a lot to do at the end of it because there's going to be so many recommendations coming out of that for government. That I'm afraid to say I ended up doing quite a lot of work this weekend.
You didn't think you'd earned a pint?
I may have had one or two glasses of wine on Friday evening, but as sort of avid watchers of Westminster will know, most of the pubs haven't reopened yet around there because they don't have outside space.
Mm, there you go. Well, this week, it seems highly, highly likely that the sleaze row is going to worsen and worsen and worsen. More came out over the weekend. It emerged that Matt Hancock owns shares in a document shredding company, which is probably handy if you're in government. It was approved for supply for NH Trusts, and the other shares were owned by his mother, his stepfather, his sister, and his brother-in-law. This is Banana Republic stuff, isn't it, Naomi?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Look, the allegations just keep coming on Cameron lobbying on behalf of Greensill, and that's prompting more and more anger from even Tory backbenchers like Bernard Jenkin. But, you know, it's also spreading. We've heard lots of talk, obviously, about the civil service mandarins breaching the rules by having outside interests. And of course, before that, the Prime Minister himself, not a couple of weeks ago, was totally embroiled in the did he, didn't he, with the Jennifer Arcuri scandal and how she may have profited from that close relationship with him as London mayor. But this weekend, there was also news of the Prime Minister's right-hand man, Eddie Lister, being a shareholder in a company that received more than $1 million in taxpayer funds for NHS contracts. So it's all getting murkier and murkier. It's often called chumminess, coziness, chumocracy, but I think we do just have to make sure that we call it corruption. And it's defrauding the taxpayer when those conflicts, it's not just good enough to talk about conflicts of interest. I've heard one minister talking about it over the weekend and some of the news briefings saying, oh, you know, it's all got to be transparent. It's got to be transparent. No, it doesn't just have to be transparent. Transparency is necessary, but not sufficient. And I'm always amazed when you compare the rules around Westminster with the rules around, say, a local authority. So in a local council meeting, if you have a conflict of interest, because say you live in the ward where a bit of housing development is meant to be going ahead, you not only have to declare that you have that interest, you then have to recuse yourself from the meeting lest you inadvertently influence the outcome. So transparency is not just, it's not just good enough to know that Matt Hancock's got, you know, familial relations and personal wealth benefit to be gained from something. They also cannot be in any way part of any decision that may possibly end up giving them any financial gain. And how can you really do that when you are a cabinet member and you've got relationships and networks all over government and Whitehall and these people that are making decisions? So it's getting murkier and murkier. And you're right, Andrew, this is a story that's just going to keep running, I think.
Is it possible to predict what you think might happen this week from this? Because, I mean, the revelations, as you say, they keep coming and they keep coming from unexpected sources. It's almost kind of, you know, it's spreading out from camera.
Well, remember that we're in an election period. So the opposition parties are smelling blood on this. This is not something they're going to take the foot off the gas from. And Labour have published, you know, a list of questions that any watchdogs or committees that are investigating this need to ask. So there's that. The journalists themselves can smell blood from across the papers. And in many cases, the papers are working together and collaborating on stories in terms of sharing intel about who knew what and when and who's linked to who and when. It's likely that this is just going to keep going. Now, one thing that is a bit frustrating is that there are various different committees and select committees that are now putting up their hands and saying, well, I'm going to be the one that investigates this. I'm going to call David Cameron to come and give me answers, etc. And in a way, that might end up diluting the impact. And it might be better if there was just one very, very heavy hitting inquiry into it. And again, it needs to be a public inquiry. The government have said that they'll do their own inquiry, but it'll be behind closed doors. And this is specifically in relation to Greensill. But one of the reasons why Best for Britain has set up the UK Trade and Business Commission is because the government cannot be allowed to mark its own homework. You have to have independent oversight of this stuff. So I don't really know how this is going to play out beyond the fact that various different select committee chairs are going to be wanting to roll up their sleeves and get stuck into this and call various former prime ministers to give evidence and former cabinet secretaries and things like that. My fear for that then is that it somehow gets diluted rather than concentrated under one banner of scrutiny.
We've been waiting for something to damage Boris Johnson for years, and it seems like nothing ever would. Just that, you know, he's so shameless that things just wash off him. Is this different? Is it gaining traction? I mean, it's like, it's kind of ironic that, you know, the Tory sleaze phrase is coming back, but, you know, in memory of the end period, the decadent phase of the Major government. But that sleaze was about exactly the kind of sex that Johnson gets away with. Mm-hmm. And this is about billions of public money. It's on a grander scale. I think Andrew Rawlinsy was making this very clearly in The Observer at the weekend. This is not just a peccadillo with your secretary. This is billions of your money.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, well, a couple of things. So first of all, a few people have been saying, what do you mean this is the return of Tory sleaze? It never went away. Now, of course, there has been sleaze across many parties. And remember, under New Labour, we had all sorts of cash for access scandals and things like that. So the Conservatives aren't uniquely positioned to have been getting into trouble over all of this. I think on Johnson specifically, this sort of feeds this version of history where we put everything on the one man, that there can be this, you know, one single person can turn the tide on things. And that so often isn't the case. And I do think that this is about a broader, further toxification, not just of him and his government, but of the entire party. And then, of course, the spillover into wider politics as well. And it's just the last thing we need in a way, because we need to restore public trust in our politics and in our democratic processes. And all these things just hurt it further and further. The rot sets in and public confidence just ebbs away. I've been running a series of focus groups across the country over the last week at Best for Britain. I listened into one in Hartlepool last week. Remember, there's a Hartlepool by-election coming up. And this sort of plague on all their houses thing just comes back again and again. And, you know, I asked one of them, well, which was the last politician that you did believe in, that you had faith in, that you thought was in it for the greater good rather than for themselves? And turns out it was Robin Cook. So, you know, you're going back 20 plus years for many of these people to be able to name somebody that they do have trust in. So it's not going to be good for Johnson. But then again, as you say, master of Teflon, the fact that the Arcuri story has now almost, you know, entirely been surpassed by David Cameron's lobbying efforts. The number 10 machine was very effective last week at knocking off politician scandal from the front pages and onto the Mandarins being on the make. So they'll be doing everything they can to deflect this. But I think that over time, and it won't be a sort of cataclysmic moment, but I think that erosion of, oh, can we really trust these people? And Rawnsley's right. You know, people are going to be feeling the pinch soon. And when the spotlight is properly shone on the billions and billions and billions of taxpayers' money that has not only been wasted, but has been given to friends and family of government ministers in order to do the wasting, I would hope that we would start to see a shift in the polls. But that's not to say that it will necessarily go in Labour's favour. Labour also need to be setting out that vision, as we've said so many times before in different shows.
It is interesting. That was a quality deputy head's must roll job last week, wasn't it, on the civil servants? Yep. As stories were leaked out, Bill Crothers' part-time position at Green still had been agreed to by the Cabinet Office. Do you think they'll be successful in pinning it on the civil service and having the reforms and the lessons learned all be happening to the little people?
That's almost certainly where they'll start, because that'll be easier and less dangerous for them to push through. Because remember, there's nothing like a nice big fat Tory party donor check making its way to you to make sure that you're doing everything you can to keep their channels of communication open with the powers that be.
Over to COVID. We in the UK might think it's the beginning of the end. It is, however, still growing worldwide at an alarming rate. Global deaths passed 3 million at the weekend. Mm. India and Brazil are continuing to grow at an alarming rate. Indian cases have topped 15 million. Do you think this kind of worsening world environment is going to affect things here? Because the sense here is almost out in the population, it's almost as if, well, we've done it now. Pubs are reopening. Cafes are open on the streets. It's kind of done. Do you think we're going to be in for a rude awakening shortly?
I do. I mean, as you say, the numbers globally are horrifying. We've passed that 3 million humans dead marker, which is, you know, incredibly sad. And in some countries like India, new variants are concerning some epidemiologists. And of course, in many countries, particularly less developed countries, vaccinations have barely begun. And no matter how well the UK vaccine rollout system is going, it'll mean absolutely nothing if new vaccine resistant strains pop up. And we keep coming back to this mantra that no one is safe until everyone is safe. And by everyone, we have to mean the entire global population, not just the UK. So will this mean we keep restrictions tight at the border? Will this slow down Johnson's already very rapid lockdown? I think almost certainly not, because our government has so rarely done the right thing over the past year, which is why we have, let's remember, among the worst health and economic indicators as a consequence of COVID in Europe and indeed the world. So there's lots of pressure at the moment to add India to the red list. That in and of itself is embroiled in the issue of geopolitics, where, of course, the UK is racing to try and get a trade deal secured with India to put pressure on India to reduce tariffs on things like whiskey and British-made vehicles. Johnson is hoping to travel there himself, which, of course, he wouldn't be able to do if we add India to the red list, or he certainly wouldn't be able to do without looking like a massive hypocrite. So I think the chances of our government, they will probably just try and do the fudged thing all the time. That's never quite enough. And I think we probably ought to be bracing ourselves for this being the first unlockdown this year. And we may well have to go back into some form of lockdown later in the year because of the grave concern of vaccine resistant variants emerging and us having to go back and re-vaccinate the elderly and the vulnerable with boosters that would cover new variants before we've even got to some of the younger people getting their first dose of this vaccine.
Unsurprisingly, a new report has found that inequality in the UK has been made worse by COVID. The Resolution Foundation's research found that British people had less savings, more debt, and weaker welfare support than people in France and Germany, and it warned that COVID could become a disease of the poor. Is this finally going to get inequality onto the agenda as part of the COVID conversation? Because people on lower incomes have suffered, we know this, much more heavily from the disease. They are not the kind of people who are able to just say, well, I think I'll just do my work from home in my slippers. You know, they have been the ones who suffered the worst. Do you think it's going to get on the agenda now, finally?
Probably not, just because we've seen decades and decades of galloping wealth and income inequality, often coupled by austerity and measures like that, that has caused the Resolution Foundation to reach this conclusion that while, you know, average earnings may be relatively comparable to places like France and Germany, actually because of lower incomes at the bottom level, because of very low levels of private savings, and of course, a much less generous social security safety net than many and most other European countries, that UK households were particularly exposed to economic shocks. What I would say, though, is that the government needs to do something to make its levelling up agenda actually mean something. And the billions it's wasting on, you know, corruption contracts and alleged corrupt contracts and, you know, wasted money giving, you know, contracts to, you know, shipping companies without ships and PPE companies that don't know how to make PPE, etc., it is going to be difficult for them to then justify. And it's going to make it much more difficult for them to spend that money, but they do need to. I think the problem is that they're going to potentially spend it on the wrong things rather than doing what we've seen Biden do, for instance, with his stimulus package, which is just so enormous and really ought to put money sort of directly in the pockets of people and begin to pump money into the kinds of sectors that can be job creators and good paying job creators as well. It's not obvious to me that this government has got that kind of industrial strategy in its mind. Its industrial strategy sort of seems to be cloaked under a military strategy and their integrated review and their sort of closer links with Indochina is about the only thing we've seen coming out of this government that gives you any indication of where their priorities are.
Well, speaking of military and geopolitical matters, one to look out for this week, it's highly possible that Alexei Navalny will die in prison. The critic of Putin is on day 19 of a hunger strike. He's been denied access to his own doctors. He has critical heart and renal issues. The US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told at CNN that there would be consequences if Mr. Navalny dies. There are protests planned across Russia in the next few days. It is a horrific thing to see, and it makes one feel very impotent.
It does. And it's really part of a suite of concerning stories that we're hearing about Russia this week. So as you say, Navalny has been on hunger strike for nearly 3 weeks. The reports are that his health is rapidly declining. He could die at any moment. And of course, remember, he's already suffered terrible poisoning in recent times. So his health is already compromised. No wonder that will be affecting his kidneys. And it's reporting that he's now suffering severe back pain. And of course, you know, often kidney pain would be felt there. And President Biden has denounced Russia over the situation. He's called it totally inappropriate. And these comments come off the back of new sanctions levied on the Kremlin by Washington and following the expulsion of Russian diplomats from the US. But actually, it's not just the US getting very, very, very concerned about Russia and expelling diplomats. There is also the military buildup along the border with the Ukraine by Russian troops. And the UK, the Russian ambassador to the UK, Andrei Kellin, was out this weekend denying that there was sort of, you know, an imminent war and saying this is just normal military preparedness exercises and things like that. But in something which is very reminiscent of the first chapter of Le Carré's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the BBC is reporting that the two Russian men who were suspected of carrying out the 2018 Salisbury poisonings here in the UK are being linked to an explosion at an arms depot in the Czech Republic in 2014. And for many years, it was thought that the explosion was just an accident. But now Prague is alleging that, in fact, it was a hostile act, potentially by the same blokes who Novichok the Skripals, because it's found that they were in the area around the time of the bombing. Now, why would the Russians want to bomb an arms depot in the Czech Republic? Well, one motive under consideration is that the arms depot was exporting to the Ukraine. Again, adding to this, you know, concern about what the Kremlin's intentions are towards the Ukraine. So lots of very concerning stories emerging this week around the geopolitics of that region, but of course also the implications that that has for the US, the UK, and other allies.
Are there any nice spires near that ammunition dump? You know, well known sort of a tourist might wish to visit.
I mean, Czech Republic is an incredibly beautiful country with lots of beautiful architecture, so it may well be.
Yeah, keep an eye on your spires, people. Finally, it's hardly the most important thing, but it's driving me to rage and shame for my club, the European Super League. announced last night, six English clubs announced that they will be joining a new midweek Euro League of 12. Manchester City, Manchester United, Arsenal, Chelsea, Tottenham, and to my shame and disgust, Liverpool, have signed up for this multi-billion pound project. Not one voice that I can see outside of the clubs themselves has been raised in its favour. Former players, fans, commentators, absolutely everybody has been, there's just been blanket disgust at this thing, this idea that's been hanging in the air for several years. UEFA and the Premier League are talking about ejecting teams from the Premier League and ejecting players from national sides. From the clubs involved, we've heard a lot of mealy-mouthed talk about the football pyramid. It just feels like, and I know, like in comparison to everything we've already talked about on the podcast so far, it's not really very important, but it just feels like the end of football to me. And I'm absolutely ashamed that my club is involved. I thought, I mean, we all expect American owners of Manchester United and Arsenal and the owner of Chelsea and the owner of Tottenham. We don't expect much of them, but I thought our owners were better. How naive I was. What a fool I was on this. I mean, our producer, Alex Reese, who's putting this together right now, he put it best on Twitter. Love to wait my entire life to see my team win the trophy that's eluded them since before I was born, only for them to immediately sack it off to go and chuck wads of £50 notes at the Petro State clubs. So there you go. Naomi, can you sympathise with me and Alex and, in fact, the supporters of all these teams?
I can. And, you know, as somebody who's not a, you know, massive football fan, although I do keep a bit of a, you know, watching eye on it, I'm struggling to see anyone that's in favour of it apart from, as you say, the sort of the rich shareholders and owners of these clubs. And as I understand it, things like this have been mooted before. Am I right? And in a way, it was sort of used to just get some concessions for the big clubs from the Champions League.
Yes.
Do you think that that could be what's happening here, that they're going to sort of push them to the brink of trying to make a change to the league? And if so, what kind of Champions League changes would they be wanting? Or do you think that this time they actually mean it and they're just going to go ahead and try and do it?
It looks like this time they actually mean it. I mean, it's always been leveraged, the idea that the big clubs, and by the way, asterisk the big clubs, because, you know, no disrespect, but some of the clubs, some of the British clubs here struggle to make the top end of the Premier League, including at the moment my own club, Liverpool. But, you know, the idea that the threat of leaving can be used to get concessions. There was supposed to be reform to the Champions League. Was supposed to be announced today. And again, that would have tilted it yet further in favour of the rich clubs for more lucrative European games, placing further pressure on clubs and squads and, you know, further down raising the importance of the Premier League, but also the importance of Championship and First Division football, which is what the entire pyramid is made out of. But my fear is that this is, like, they've actually pushed it too far now with a full announcement, full backing. The finances are all in place. And, you know, there comes a point where, you know, the threat that you make, never intending to fulfill, you finally go too far and you have to fulfill it. It's been a very, very weird 24 hours, though. We've, you know, Boris Johnson issued one statement saying that he was against it. This was presented on the front of the Telegraph as Prime Minister goes to war with the big clubs on the back of one statement. Nigel Farage tweets that he's against a European Union of Football. She's like, well, congratulations on making a balloon animal to your liking out of these facts. Congratulations on aligning it with your pre-existing convictions on these things. Football is a strange thing because you suspend your rational mind, you know, when you go into the world of football. You know, it was never a penalty, or it was deliberately a penalty. You can deny the evidence of your own eyes, and that expands out into how you feel about the way your clubs are owned and operated. The number of clubs who've had to, like, you know, their fans have turned a blind eye to the, you know, the truly seedy derivations of their finances. Again, Liverpool,
but I think the terraces is where we can win the culture war. And I mean, I'm not familiar with how, you know, favourable towards football or not our listeners are. But if they're anything like the cast, then it's pretty mixed, I would say. But I think what we've got to remember is that, you know, football clubs are predominantly, but not entirely, of course, attended by younger people. They tend to be urban. Football really, you know, outclass many other industries in terms of things like taking the knee and Black Lives Matter. So I think that the terraces are somewhere where we can begin to win the culture war. And I don't think we should be sort of sneering at it. And so I think my plea is that for any listeners that sort of dismiss football as, oh, that's just, you know, not something I'm interested in, that's just yobs and hooligans. No, it isn't. It really isn't.
It hasn't been like that way for decades.
Yeah. In many areas, I think it's been more progressive than some of the other institutions in this country. So I really hope that the fans and the clubs themselves and the FA and others and the, you know, in the Premiership really, you know, step up to this and fight it. And hopefully then, you know, we can, as you say, have that spillover into leadership on other issues too.
Well, I think, to be honest, I think you've been optimistic there now, because football fans care primarily about football. But what has been interesting about it is that you know, the clubs that have, the British clubs, the English clubs that have been involved in this, because no Scottish club has been invited, they have active fan groups who have been uniformly enraged and rejecting this. Yeah. And it's all from the fact that, you know, the game is built on tradition and it's been part of your life since you were a kid. And what the recurring theme is, I would rather have a boring 0-0 draw with Burnley on a Saturday afternoon than meeting Atletico Madrid for the fourth time in the season in a game with no stakes and no risk.
But one thing that is worth mentioning is Ali McGovern MP, Shadow Sports Minister. She has had a good reminder out today that, of course, in the Conservative manifesto at the last election, they promised a fan-led review, which has yet to materialise. So let's keep the pressure up on the government to deliver that.
And just one thing to bear in mind as well, the thing that makes this league so kind of egregious is that although the full details aren't clear yet, it's pretty clear that none of the founding teams can be relegated. So they will be permanently in there. So there's no risk for them. So it's a meaningless game. And the comparison is made with the NFL, where franchise clubs stay in the league forever. But the big difference is that in the NFL, there is the draft system where the teams that finish at the bottom get first pick of the best players in the next set of players that come into the league. So there is an element of, there's almost an element of fairness in the recruitment of players. So what's being described here is something where you've got the similar league model to the NFL, i.e. you can never be relegated. But without that turnover in players and the injection of the best talent into supposedly the bottom teams that enables them to progress. So you've got the worst of both sides, and you've also got salary caps in the NFL, which you won't have in this. So it's like, it's not bringing the NFL model to Europe. It's this disgusting hybrid designed only to ensure that the top clubs stay at the top. And I think it may end a lot of people's relationship with football. But it's going to be the biggest week for football since the establishment of the Premier League in the next 7 days. Astonishing things will happen, and doubtless incredibly depressing things will happen as well. But, you know, we are where we are. So, Naomi, thank you for joining me early in the morning to talk about football, which you love so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
As well as everything else. Thanks for joining us. Listeners, thanks for listening. Remember, there are new bunkers on Monday to Thursday and now Saturday as well, when Saturday comes. Support us on Patreon in our valuable work. If you search Patreon Bunker Podcast, you'll see you can sign up for very modest amounts of money and you will get the podcast early. You'll get amazing merchandise. It's just remarkable. Naomi, thank you.
Thanks very much. Have a good week, everyone.
And we'll see you tomorrow.
Andrew Harrison and Naomi Smith appear on behalf of Podmasters Sport Management Limited. The assistant shareholders were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronievich, and your executive vice president is me, Alex Rees. Music by Kenny Dickinson. You've been listening to The Bunker Daily, sponsored by Gaz, Matt, Pet, So, One, Nerd. No.